Welcome to the Evolution 2.0 podcast, where we explore the intersection of art, technology, business, biology, and spirituality. Here, you'll discover new trends in evolution that are changing the way we think about everything. This is your host, Perry Marshall, author of Evolution 2.0, 80/20 Sales and Marketing, and Guides to Ethernet, Google, and Facebook. I'm founder of the Evolution 2.0 Prize, a quest for the missing link between earth science, the information age, and life itself. Let's join the conversation now.
Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on who and what you are and what you're doing. Good to see you. We're going to have a very interesting conversation today. Good to see who decided to show up today. I know some of you. Boy, it looks like Gary Peel's in there. It looks like Teresa Sedmak's in there. Looks like Paul Perez. Hello, Steve, Rob, Phil, Harry, Jeff, and looks like a bunch of people that
I see. John, I see Teresa.
As a just a Zoom conversation meeting, not a webinar, because I think it would be fun to talk to you guys as we talk about this. Brian texted me about a week ago, and he sent me a couple pictures of me and my 8-year-old at the time daughter and being in China. He goes, you know, this is the 20th anniversary of us having that argument on that bus. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. And Brian does like calendar anniversary. He'll remember dates of things. Now I'm pretty good at remembering stuff, but he's really good. And he said, you know, maybe we should do a Zoom meeting and just like tell this whole story, because most people have never heard Brian's part of the story. And when I tell my evolution story, I always talk about Brian, and then I go on and I go on and I go on, and people go, so whatever happened to Brian? And I'm like, oh, well, and I give him sort of an answer, but I just think you'd be more interested in the more complete answer that you get from him. So this, what a perfect thing, and great to see all you guys. I'm glad you guys think this is interesting and decide to take part of your Saturday and sit here with us and talk to us about it. So maybe we could start with Brian, because most people on this call know me well enough or have heard my stories. Probably a lot of them have never heard any stories from Brian. And Brian, I don't know where you want to start, but I imagine it would be seminary or living.
Oh, we can go way back. We can go back to the grandparents.
Yes, we can, because we're blood brothers. So
same mom, same dad.
Yep.
This is fun. Perry, it's actually a pleasant surprise that we're having this be just kind of an open group thing. I think that's adorable. Love seeing all the smiling faces on an American Saturday morning, wherever in the world you happen to be. Our family, Perry, as far back as I can possibly trace, was some form of Christian, either Methodist or Baptist, going back 100 years in both directions. So our maternal grandfather was a Baptist minister who would travel the roads of Virginia and preach at multiple churches on a Sunday. Our parents went to the same Bible college and met on a train on the way to Washington, D.C. for a Youth for Christ, big national jamboree, you know. So, and then our dad moved out to Nebraska. Well, he took the family out to Nebraska so he could take a job at a place called Back to the Bible, where he worked for 14 years. So we went to a fundamental church, and we went to a Christian school for grade school, and we were card-carrying young earth creationists. The earth was 6,000 years old, and it was created in 6 literal days by the spoken word of God. And on the 7th day, he rested. That was 6,000 years ago. And then somewhere to the tune of 4,000 years ago, he destroyed the entire earth with a literal flood. And all of the animals and all of the people, you know, and everything came literally off that ark somewhere in what is modern day Turkey and filled the earth. Yep. And that's how we got to where we were today. And we believed this, and we studied this with some pretty significant intensity all the way into junior high and high school. Mm-hmm. Perry, I don't know at what point you ever started to question that yourself, but I didn't on through. I mean, the first seeds of doubt were planted in my brain when I took a geology class in college, but they were very small, very insignificant. So I thought at the time, seeds of doubt. But that's what I believed. That was the story I bought. And Perry moved off to Chicago. Perry got married, got his degree, moved off to Chicago, worked as an engineer. And I went on to seminary after I finished my college degree. And I went to California, an arch conservative seminary called the Master Seminary. The president was a famous radio preacher by the name of John MacArthur. He still is. And we were taught to preach the word of God verse by verse. And young earth creationism was just an understood part of all of that. And when I graduated from seminary in 1999, I got the opportunity to go work in China to be an undercover missionary. And China was just a massive culture shock and just jarring to my system. It was a very, very secular environment, unlike anything I had ever been in before. And I was on my own, just trying to fend for myself. And somewhere in 2001, I was there from 2000 to 2004. And somewhere in 2001, seeds of doubt got planted in me when I saw an atheist skeptic on television. And I started using the internet and a lot of free time and reading stories and websites and articles of people who had left Christianity or didn't believe Christianity. And this started to rock my world and scared me. And I started swapping emails with Perry, saying, okay, Perry, you grew up the same way I did. You got the same education I did up to a certain point, but you've kind of gone a different direction, but you're still very much Christian. Mm-hmm. So talk to me. I'm having serious doubts here. And we wrangled and we wrestled for a couple of years via email. And by early 2003, I had cut off ties with the church that supported me back home in LA. I stayed on in China. By the end of 2003, I one email late in the year, I just declared to Perry, look, I can't call myself Christian anymore. And I never knew what kind of impact personally this was having on Perry, other than what he chose to voice to me. But I had completely left all the values and the beliefs that had nurtured me growing up. And Perry was on the other side of the planet. I didn't know what he was struggling with. Well, I finally decided to move home. Circumstances made it so that it was time for my China adventure to end. And this was March of 2004. I called Perry, and the plan was actually that I was going to move home and work full time for Perry. And that worked really well. And I did. And great things became of that. But Perry was like, oh, my goodness, I promised Tana, my daughter, that we were going to go visit Uncle Brian at some point before he moved home. And so he scrambled at the last minute and pulled a trip together. And he and Tana came to China. They spent a few days in Beijing, if I remember right, and then came out to Lijiang, where I was. And so that brought us to the second week of April 2004. So here I am. I'm a few weeks from moving home. I'm a newfound, almost, but not quite, almost atheist. And Perry and I are there. And we had some free time, Perry and me. Tana was there, of course, but we had some free time to talk about stuff. And this photo you see here is the day of our little trip out to Leaping Tiger Gorge. That's Perry and me and his daughter, Tana. She was 8 at the time. And at one point during that day, the subject of evolution came up. So from Lijiang, this is just some pics of the road on the way there. This is gorgeous scenery, by the way. Lijiang is as beautiful as any part of the world as you'll ever visit. It's the foothills of the Himalayas, if you can call these foothills. That's what that is. But we rented a driver in a cheap little van for, I don't know, 60 renminbi or 100 renminbi or something like that. It was like $12 for the entire day. And this was the van we were in. And the scenery on the way there is just absolutely gorgeous. So we stopped and got some pictures, but we had some time to talk. And Perry, I don't remember when the subject of evolution came up specifically. Maybe you do, but it was just sooner or later, this kind of thing was going to come up in conversation. And, you know, at that point, you and I had had 2 years of back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, but really no chance to do hardcore in-person one-on-one sparring about any of these questions. So at this point, I had completely rejected all of the young earth creationism I'd grown up with. And I had decided that, you know, the classic neo-Darwinian view must be how all of life and biodiversity came to be what it is. You know, DNA makes copies of itself. It makes mistakes. Sometimes the mistakes are beneficial. Nature just selects for whatever organisms can survive. And voila, there you go. And to this, you know, this has worked for 3.5 billion years. And here we are today. Right. So, Perry, I don't know if there's anything you want to say about what you remember of that particular conversation. And then I can make some more specific comments about what I remember.
Yeah, I remember it was fairly early in the bus trip. And yeah, we had been tussling about this for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So this wasn't entirely new to me, but Brian had lurched much further than I realized all of a sudden now that he's in person. He was still somewhere roughly in the territory of what a lot of people today might call Christian deconstruction. Like, that's a big word in the podcast sphere.
I don't think I know that term.
Yeah. I kind of thought that's where he was at, but he was actually almost atheist and he was spitting nails angry.
Yes.
Which scared me to death. And one of the reasons that it scared me was I had already been engaging with atheists at this point for a couple of years. In the winter of 2003, like New Year's, I made a New Year's resolution. And what I wrote down on a little card at somebody's little party was I wrote down mail order evangelism. What that meant was I've now learned marketing and advertising well enough to be consulting and doing gigs and having helped a company get built and sold. And I've got some chops and I've learned how to be a good communicator. I should use my communication skills. Oh, maybe a little bit the way my parents or grandparents or relatives did. I ought to be talking about the gospel of Jesus. And so I created a website called Coffee House Theology, and it still exists and it still works. And I wrote an email series called Seven Great Lies of Organized Religion. And it is intended to take a person who's kind of skeptical or cynical and explain why your cynicism is not about Jesus. Your cynicism is about the people who masquerade as Jesus followers. So,
Perry, I had forgotten that you had been doing that for a couple of years or a year or two at that point.
Yes. And so I had several formative experiences that somewhat prepared me to be talking to Brian about this.
Well, don't forget that at Willow Creek, you had at that point spent how many years doing your like Sunday afternoon? Well, that's where the term coffee house theology came from.
Yes. Yes.
Because you had already been doing this at Willow Creek in person with people.
Gary Poole is on this call, interestingly. And Gary's been a friend of mine for 30 years. And Gary, back in the day, was the director of evangelism at Willow Creek. Willow Creek was really close to the largest church in the United States. And Laura and I went there. So this is really worth unpacking a little bit. So Brian and I grew up in identical environments up until I got married at age 20. And then our paths started diverging. So he stayed at the same church, which was incredibly ultra conservative and frankly, a very unhealthy church from my adult point of view now. And I started diverging. And so I moved to Chicago. I go to Willow Creek. Willow Creek was culture shock to what I grew up in.
To our horror, he went to Willow Creek because it was legendary.
Yeah, it was. I mean, to them, Willow was like the bra-burning liberals. Now, most people would consider Willow Creek to be the Christian right, but they were a lot more quote-unquote liberal than where I grew up. And I found it to be a breath of fresh air. They fixed church. That was my gut level reaction the first time I visited. Like, they fixed it. Oh my goodness, it is not that calcified, you know, culture shock, like weird, like you have to explain 750 things to a visitor if you were ever to bring them. You wouldn't normally even want to bring a visitor. You get coerced into bringing visitors. Willow Creek was the kind of place you actually kind of wanted to invite your friends to come along because it was such a cool place.
And it was not, among other things, it was not hellfire and damnation every week.
No, it was very friendly. It was very contemporary. And they were leading the edge on changing the culture of church. And tons of churches were very curious about what they were doing. And within a year, I fell into something that I found absolutely, positively fascinating, thrilling. And it was called Seeker Small Groups. And Gary Poole, who's on this call, invented these things. And a Seeker Small Group is a Bible study for people who don't believe the Bible. Like, there's no presumption when you hold one of these groups. There's no expectation that all of the other people in the group believe the Bible the way Perry and Brian did growing up. In fact, the expectation is they probably don't. And so I got going with this, and pretty soon I've got a burned out Catholic, a Buddhist, an agnostic, an atheist, an ex-Lutheran, and, you know, fill in the blank. I have like 4, 5, 6, 8 people in a group, and we're all here and we're discussing Christianity and we're discussing the Bible. And I quickly learn, dude, if you think your job is to be the Bible answer man, you are wrong. Now, knowing Bible answer man stuff will certainly be helpful at times, but it does not work to fire hose people with stuff. They have to discover this on their own. And when they ask you all kinds of questions, you cannot let yourself get threatened by that. You just got to roll with it. And so I started doing that, and I loved it. And after a few years, I was running the longest running Seeker Small Group in the history of Willow Creek. And they would send me the hard people because the staff knew, you know, they got instructions. So people would fill out cards and turn them in at the service, and they could check a box that said, I am interested in Seeker Small Groups. And if anything the person said gave the indication that they were intellectually difficult or sophisticated or something like that, they would probably send them to Perry's group. And so I kind of specialized in this stuff. And so getting a bunch of questions from Brian about, well, I don't know if I believe this or I don't know about that, that was already in my wheelhouse. And I had already handled a whole lot of difficult people. And on top of this, we had a group called Truth Quest, which met once a month, and it was a Christian apologetics group. So the whole idea of this group, which had anywhere from 50 to 100 people that would show up every month, was we would have presentations that related to the factual issues around Christianity. Was there really a Jesus? Did he really die on the cross? Did he rise from the dead? What about the historical questions around the nation of Israel, or, you know, the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, and Paul, and all that stuff? So I was already immersed. I was as qualified to be talking to Brian as anybody you could easily find on the street. Now, I wasn't a college professor, but, you know, as far as anybody you could find at any normal church, I was like the best choice that you could have to be talking to Brian.
And from my perspective at this point, this was the end of 2000. Wait, my dialogues with Perry started in the very beginning of 2002. And from my perspective there alone in China as a desperate missionary, this was the greatest crisis of my life.
Oh, and, yeah. You can't overstate how big of a deal this was for both of us.
Yeah. And to have Perry there, my own blood brother who knew my upbringing intimately and then was in the middle of all of this, I could not have asked. Heaven itself could not have sent or arranged a better person to be having this conversation, right?
Yeah.
So,
so I felt like, you know, I was pretty well prepared. And then I had started this email series on called, so what mail order evangelism turned into was, I made a really simple website. I made an autoresponder series. I wrote a series of seven emails called Seven Great Lies of Organized Religion. And I started sending them out. And what that was designed to do was engage a skeptical person and then sort of turn them around a bend and let out the clutch and begin talking about, you know, what's the difference between the religious hypocrisy that all religious institutions get sucked into versus, you know, the purity of the crystal clear message of Jesus, which, you know, if you dig a little deeper, you can find. And so Google ads were brand new. I could spend pennies and get people on this email list. Like I was getting people on this email list for 5, 10, 15 cents a person. And now I was in this evangelism traffic experiment by a brand new Google Ads expert. And like, there's several people on this call that were into Google Ads when they were really new and really cheap and really easy to do. And it was like a magic carpet ride. Nobody really understood this. And if you did, it was like, you could make tons of money. And I was not making money on this at all. It was a tax write-off, but I was spending a few $1,000s a month sending people to my website and all of their replies come back to me. And I'm on the unvarnished internet. They have not been filtered through Willow Creek. Like in my seeker groups, they had been through about six different steps before they ever got to me. So even though they might be very skeptical, they might be have all kinds of questions, they were also very hungry and they were also very curious and they were willing to show up. And that's not the same as somebody who wanders into some email series, gets on an email list, and then everything that comes in makes them really angry and then they start replying back. And so I'm getting the replies of all of these people. And this is also helping warm me up to knowing something about navigating a conversation about evolution. Now, I never really studied evolution up to this point at all. All I really knew is what I would hear at a place like a Truth Quest meeting at the Willow Creek Apologetics Group. But Willow Creek one time had a speaker, and his name was Hugh Ross, and he's an astrophysicist, and he's still around today, and you can go find his stuff. He's written tons of books, and he is really sharp. And he gave an absolutely brilliant talk. It's on my Evo 2 website, by the way. If you go to evo2.org and search Hugh Ross, you will find this talk. It's got to be 30 years old now. And it was called New Scientific Evidence for the God of the Bible. And I had gotten into an argument with somebody at work about the age of the earth. And the guy was an engineer. And it literally only took me 2 minutes to figure out, you know, he might be right. The earth might not be 6,000 years old. Don't go trying to defend that. So I had kind of backed off. And then I go hear Hugh Ross. And Hugh Ross gave a stunning, brilliant explanation as to why the universe is 13 billion years old and the Big Bang is like the most miraculous thing ever. And it's fine-tuned to 120 decimal places. And the fact that the universe even exists is a miracle all by itself. And so he painlessly converted me to, okay, the universe is old. The earth is old. There's a whole different way of looking at this. That's cool. So, and this is a major stumbling block for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I think teaching people that the earth is 6,000 years old is absolutely a colossal mistake. It's just, anyway, but I don't want to get into that. So I've already had dozens and dozens of skeptical people talk to them for hours and hours and hours. I've already been to the apologetics classes at Willow Creek and all of that. And I've also had a whole bunch of conversations via email privately with these people who sign up, because that website I showed you, Coffeehouse Theology, eventually I had 75,000 people signed up to that. And every single one of them that sent me an email and appeared willing to have a reasonable conversation and not just call me names, I would engage with them. But I had never dealt with anything like a guy who knows all the same background as me and has gone to one of the most conservative seminaries in the world and learned Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic and knows where all the bones are buried and has the kind of capacity for asking penetrating questions that you and I know Brian, you know me and Brian to be like. Because you could say that the education that he and I had is kind of like Hasidic Jews or Jesuits or something like that. It's extremely rigorous. And so that combination, Brian was still asking harder questions than anything I was reading in the apologetics books, anything that I was getting from all these email people, and anything I got in a secret group. And I'm like, well, I think these are the real questions. And so he was pulling me along. And so I was floundering already when I came to see him in China, which he didn't realize.
Mm.
And I felt like I had to be honest about this. Like, I can't just like wall off, go, hey, you know what? I'm just not going to go there. I'm going to just keep taking my kids to Sunday school. I couldn't do that. And so I have to be intellectually honest about the questions Brian is asking, and he's asking the best ones. And so he's like dragging me underwater, and I feel like I'm drowning, and I'm already feeling threatened. And then we get to China, and he's pissed off. He was really pissed off, and there was some venom behind these questions. And so we're on this bus. It's fairly early in the bus ride. And I go, Brian, look at the hand at the end of your arm. This is a nice piece of engineering. You don't think this is a series of random accidents, do you? And he pushes back. And I think, oh, my God, they got him. Like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Like, oh, my, he just flipped. And this really freaked me out. And when I asked him that question, I don't even think I realized that at the time, but I was retreating to my most primal sense of the existence of God, which was my engineering sensibilities. All I had to do is look at my hand as an engineer and go, oh yeah, there's God. It's sort of like, I don't know how many people have told me, I watched my wife have a baby, and after that, I believed in God. It was the gestalt of, oh my goodness, what I just witnessed is so miraculous and so incredible. Oh yeah, there's something bigger out there. There is something going on. I was having that kind of a reaction. And then he comes right back at me. And probably most of you have heard this story. Falcons, random mutations, DNA copying errors. All you need is natural selection to get better and better. And I thought, I cannot think of anything I've ever learned in engineering that would support what he just told me. Like, not a thing. I get a complete blank when I try to recall any fact that would support what he said. But I know if there was a bunch of biologists here in this van, they would sit there and they go, yep, 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 yep. I know that. Do they know something I don't know? Do I know something they don't know? What's up with that? And I just thought right there, that second, this argument with Brian is really unpleasant. This is not fun. This does not feel like vacation. And I know I am not going to convince him of anything today. That's for sure. So you know what? Since I'm already underwater, I am going to go home and I am going to let science make this decision for me. And then I'll just add one more little thing. Over the next few months, I wanted to keep arguing with Brian, but Brian did not want to keep arguing with me. And so the people that I had to argue with were the people on the email list. And so I just kept cranking up the traffic. And I'm like, well, now that I have a full-on existential crisis of my own, and I'm trying to figure this out, and all of these questions that Brian's raising, he doesn't really want to talk about anymore because he's already made up his mind. I guess I'm going to have these conversations with those people because there's an infinite supply of them. And a few of them are really, really, really smart, like needles in haystacks. And so I started engaging more and more. In fact, I created a second email series called Cosmic Fingerprints, which turned into Evolution 2.0, which was about all the science stuff. And see, this was as much to address my own questions and doubts as it was to do any kind of evangelism.
Harry, when did you launch Cosmic Fingerprints?
That was like a year later.
Okay.
We had a conference at Willow Creek and Hugh Ross came and talked at our church and we got to meet him and stuff. And it was very well attended. And I decided to take some of that stuff, turn it into an email series. So now I had two. And what turned into the Evolution 2.0 email series, that one racked up 175,000 subscribers. And it worked the same way. If they replied, I answered them. And so my rationale was, there's like all the Jesus and Bible stuff, and that's website number one. Then there's all the science and faith stuff, which is website number two. And if being a Christian is delusional, I'm going to find out. And I'm going to see if I can defend this to the best of my ability. I'm going to try, and I may find out that I can't. And if I can't, then I can't, and I'm going to stop believing this, and I'll be like Brian. And that scared me to death. It absolutely scared me to death, but I was willing to go there because I felt it would be intellectually dishonest to be anything else.
Let's pick up from there in just a minute, and I'll fill everyone in on some specifics from my end of this story on that particular day. So I think you can see my screen again.
Yep.
This is the northwest part of Yunnan province in China, which you can go look up online if you want to see some pretty pictures. Obviously, lots of farmland, but this is mountain country. And we're in this van. It's probably a 2.5 hour ride to Leaping Tiger Gorge. And as Perry said, I had my sort of stock answer to his question about, you know, the hand at the end of my arm. And again, Perry's not a young earth creationist at this point. He's still convinced that biology and nature cannot possibly be this blind mechanistic process that scientists claim that it is, right?
That's
and so
right.
So we did this back and forth. And at one point I'm like, here, look, Perry, tell me if this is feasible. And by the way, note that word feasible, because this was how it was operating in my mind. I'm like, so, and again, we're driving through this terrain. I'm like, just imagine that there's a species of falcon right here in Yunnan province, and over a space of 100 miles square, is it possible, Perry, that in that physical geographic space over a stretch of, I don't know, let's say 10,000 years, is it possible that somewhere some falcon is going to end up with a mutation that's going to give the falcon 20% clearer, sharper vision at a distance? And that was the question I put to Perry. And the answer was like, I guess maybe that's feasible. I don't know if that's exactly how Perry answered it, but that's kind of my memory of it, you know. And by the way, that would still be my answer today if you ask. It's like, well, okay, yeah. I mean, I guess that's feasible. And it, as vaguely as I remember from 20 years ago, it quieted the conversation for the moment because I had come up with something feasible. But what we imagine nature might do or could do has so little to do with how nature actually really works. Right?
Ain't that the truth?
So, you know, I didn't realize that I was pulling Perry under at that point, and I didn't realize that this was sending him further on yet another journey. But don't miss this. That feasibility thing about the Falcons that quieted Perry for the moment, it quieted me down too. So what do I mean by that? I've shared this before in other places, that during that stretch of time, particularly that last few months in China, by the way, this was getting me kind of emotional as Perry was describing me that, because those last few months in China were the angriest months of my life. You know, I have expended absolutely everything in my life for this Christianity, and now here I am, I'm on my own, and I'm just pissed. And just the sense that I had been lied to and lied to and lied to my entire life, and now what am I going to do? So anyway, during that stretch of time, I would go out for a walk on a particular afternoon, and I'd go walking by a tree. And I would see the tree, and I'd see the leaves, and I'd see the way that, you know, it spreads to the sky. And, you know, knowing what I know about how trees take in carbon dioxide and convert them to oxygen, and they're beautiful and they're fractal and all of those things. And for a split second, it would wake me up, so to speak. And I'd be like, really? Seriously? Brian, like, this beautiful organic living thing is nothing but a mechanistic combination of millennia of mistakes that are culled by natural selection. Like, that's it? Seriously? And I would think this for 5 seconds, and then I'd snap out of it, and I'd be like, no, 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 come on. Science. Okay. And I can't tell you how draining to the soul that actually was. In fact, I didn't even realize at the time how draining that actually was. But again, the little feasibility thing I did with Perry about the Falcons in Yunnan province was just a way for me to rationalize that and push it out of my awareness. But you cannot shut up those voices, those little instinctual voices inside you. They will come up again and again and again and again. Because nature is just so much more interesting. And specifically, living systems are just so much more unbelievably interesting than that. So back to you, Perry, and we can pick up that the interestingness of living systems in a moment.
Well, yeah, so we used to get a magazine called Sensors Magazine at my office as an engineer. You know, sensors like temperature sensors, light sensors, pressure sensors. And it always struck me, well, the only reason anybody can make a sensor is either A, they pay really close attention to how biology works and then they mimic it. So like a camera works the same as an eye. You're just imitating an eye when you build a camera. Or they learn some really weird nuanced thing about physics and they go, ah, aha, I can figure out a way to how to detect that little thing and turn it into a signal. And so the further I went into engineering, the more I admired the ingenuity of nature. And so Brian is tempting me with that little feasibility thing. And then he pried me open. I'm like, okay, now I got to go figure out evolution. Because there is this disconnect between what I know all the biologists say they think and everything I know about engineering. It does not match up. And so I go home and I hit the books and I start buying books. And like, my library is full of all these books now. I mean, a lot of what you see here is a result of that bus ride. Like, okay, well, you know, I'm a successful young entrepreneur. I can afford to spend a couple thousand dollars a month on traffic, on a evangelist experiment. I can afford to buy books. So here we go. And pretty soon I'm reading scientific papers and like, you're not going to figure this out reading books that you buy at Barnes and Noble. You're going to have to figure this out reading scientific papers. And so down I go. Well, really only two.
By the way, I just want to say this. A lot of you are familiar with Perry's metaphor from Beowulf about going to the bottom of the swamp. Bottom of the swamp is common parlance in Perry lingo. Perry, you were flattering me in previous when you were talking about how my questions were as deep and as real as any of you. Know. That's what I do. I go look for the bottom of the swamp. And that's what you do.
Yeah.
You go look for the bottom of the swamp. Yeah. So that was behind when you said you went down.
Yes. And I had had a bottom of the swamp experience about 7 or 8 years before that in an electrical engineering class, writing a paper about a certain topic where I had to get all the way down to the base level math of how this certain thing works. It was an acoustics problem. And I figured it out and I knew what it felt like when you hit the bottom of the swamp and everything like fits together and you understand how it works. And I go, I am looking for that feeling in biology. And I am going to pursue that until, as scared as I am, as terrified as I am, I'm going to pursue that until I hit that bottom of the swamp sensation. So here we go. And I do not know. I was really scared. Like, well, I got a wife, 4 kids. Xander was just born a few weeks after that China trip, by the way. Mm-hmm. Life seems to work. I think Christianity is true, but maybe it's not. And maybe I'm going to bail on this whole thing like Brian. Well, damn the torpedoes. Here we go. Laura was really nervous. She knew there wasn't a thing in the world she could do to stop this from happening. It scared her. Like, well, here we go. And so I go down the rabbit hole. And it took me about 2 weeks to figure out that what Brian was telling me about falcons, that dog don't hunt. That is not how it works.
I didn't know it was 2 weeks.
Yeah, it was about 2 weeks. But I had also had so many conversations from those emails that I knew I couldn't dismiss evolution itself. Very quickly, I started having a feeling evolution might be true. There's a lot of reasons to believe that evolution is true. It just don't work the way Brian told me on the bus. I think it might work some other way. And I had the foresight, or I had enough imagination to realize, you know, if it works some other way, that's really impressive. If it works some other way, then the creationists are selling God short. So now I was getting intrigued. I was getting really intrigued. So back to you, Brian.
Well, you know, I left China and I came home spitting angry. By the way, I'll just add, the end of that day, Perry, we were scheduled to go over to Richard's house for evening dinner. And they're sitting on the couch to our Chinese hosts. They didn't know what we were talking about, but we got into an argument. And I think the subject was homosexuality. And I was so raging angry about that subject itself and how Christianity had always dealt with it that I just laid into you spitting mad yelling.
I remember.
And years later, you told me, Brian, it was that night, same day as the bus ride, the van ride to Leaping Tiger Gorge. You're like, Brian, it was that day I realized something inside of you had died.
Yeah, that's what it felt like.
It makes me very sad to say that now, in sort of a bittersweet way, because I'm not there now.
That scared me. It absolutely scared me to death. Yes, I had my own concerns about my own point of view of the world and everything. But it's like, Brian was so angry and he was sounding exactly like a nail spitting atheist. It was like my sweet brother, like, has turned into one of these religion bashing monsters. Oh my goodness. Like, it just frightened me. That was a really major moment.
For interest of time, what I want to encourage everyone to do is, if you are interested in my full story, you can go to YouTube and you can look up Brian's story from missionary to almost atheist to the present day. I bet if you just look up Brian missionary atheist, it'll probably get you there on YouTube. And you can go watch a video where I tell the full story in detail.
Is that with a podcaster person?
No, that was the conversation with you at the Eclipse event.
Oh, okay. Evo2.org/Brian.
Oh, there you go. I didn't even know that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Bryan. And you can hear the whole story. I moved home and I battled this and battled this and battled this for several years. And a very short story is just after New Year's Day in 2010, I was down in Austin, Texas with my friends Drew and Jessica, and they invited me to go to church with them, which was fine with me. And I'm sitting there in the service and I'm grumbling angry at this evangelical, you know, contemporary Christian worship. And I suddenly had a realization. And the realization was this: it's been a mantra for me for years. Hate is just another word for want but cannot have. And I realized in that moment, sitting there in the church service, that all of my life I had wanted the Bible's version of things and the Bible's description of God to be true. And now I had reached the point where I had decided it wasn't. And it filled me with hate because I wanted something, but I couldn't have it. And I started sobbing there in the church service, just like shaking level sobbing. And my friends Drew and Jessica came around me, and eventually the pastor who had run the service came over and sat with me and prayed. And I just had 10 or 15 minutes of just open sobbing emotional release about this. It's making me emotional to talk about it now. But just realizing what I had wanted all those years, and just feeling the feeling of disillusionment, and just finally seeing what was actually going on inside of me and being able to just let it out. And I let it out that day in that church in Austin, Texas, in January of 2010. And I have literally not been the same since that moment. To this, I would not describe my, I'm not a Christian. I would not describe myself that way. I'm open to the idea of God. I'm certainly open to the idea of consciousness behind the universe and a designer behind the universe. Biology is a wonderful and beautiful and amazing thing, and it's just an indication that there's something behind the universe that is so much greater than us and just absolutely uncanny. And I'm comfortable with that, and I'm happy with that. And nothing in all those years, from all those years of anger, has ever come back since that day in 2010. And then Perry, that was the major, major, major transition point for me. And what Perry discovered in his journey through evolution was itself just absolutely, absolutely fascinating and amazing. And Perry, what you know, and my understanding is the single biggest difference maker for you was the work of Jim Shapiro by way of the work of Barbara McClintock. Am I right?
Yeah, so there were really two steps for me. One of them was, and this really only took me a couple of weeks, it was realizing that if you haven't figured out where life come from, you haven't solved any of this. And nobody can even answer a question as simple as where did the genetic code come from? Much less where did a complete cell come from or how did any of that happen. I think 90% of what you hear about the origin of life is a bunch of hand waving. It's marketing, not science. And I know marketing really well. So there's a lot of BS in the origin of life field. And so the first one was, well, if evolution is 1,000% true, you still have to figure out where did it get started in the first place. And all the codes we know the origin of are designed. So there's design at the fabric. At the very least, there's some kind of design principle in the fabric of the universe. And it's not, you know, falcon DNA having random mutations. So that was the first step. And that turned into a $10 million prize for the origin of the genetic code. But about 2 years in, I was still grinding away on, it looks like evolution is true, but this explanation that I'm always getting in all the biology books cannot possibly be right. This was part of growing up too, is as an engineer, as a thinker, as a person who understands mathematics and can, you know, read a scientific paper and try to dissect what's going on. There was something to me trusting what I knew that I knew that I knew, and not believing a bunch of experts who pretend to be able to explain something that they actually do not understand. And I was, after, let's say, a year in, I felt like I am pretty sure all the people that think they understand how evolution works are wrong. It cannot possibly work that way. But I also don't think the creationists are right. I think there's something else going on here. And when I found somebody, it was somebody from Hugh Ross's organization, sent me one of Jim's papers. And when I read it, it was like my head exploded. I was like, I've been looking for this. Why isn't anybody talking about this? Well, probably about 6 or 7 years later, I became friends with Jim. And that's become one of my most significant mentoring relationship in science. But as soon as I was onto that, I'm like, oh, now we're cooking with gas. Because what living things do is so astonishingly more sophisticated than either one of these political camps is even interested in finding out about, let alone telling. Like, this is so interesting. Like, somebody's got to do a good job of explaining this, and nobody has done it. So I wrote the book Evolution 2.0, which took me 6 years. Why? Somebody has got to explain this correctly, because this is the biggest story in science. Why isn't anybody talking about this? And so one thing has led to another, to another, to another, to another. You know, I was chairing a session at a cancer conference at MD Anderson 2 months ago. Who could have possibly fathomed such a thing?
Hey, Perry, you don't know this, but after reading Dennis and Ray's book, which I'll comment on in just a second, I went back and was like, okay, I need to do a deep dive back through Perry's book again. So I pulled it off the shelf, your Evolution 2.0, Breaking the Deadlock Between Darwin and Design. I didn't tell you this. This was like 3-4 weeks ago. I was dumbstruck at how well-written it is. Specifically the chapters on the five blades of the Swiss Army knife, which are the heart and soul and meat of the book. And the five different ways that living things, just the five different ways that living things work with the genome and with DNA.
Yeah.
And I know your effort, you know, you did your, what's the term you use? Your poor man's peer review.
Yes.
And your determination was, this is going to be understandable to a high school senior, maybe an eighth grader, maybe a seventh or sixth grader,
yep.
Because it is. I think a smart sixth grader could read this and have no difficulty following it. And I think I'm dumbstruck at how clean and easy and readable it is. I'm genuinely dumbstruck. So well done, Perry.
Well, there is a phrase, easy reading is damn hard writing.
Yes. I think Mark Twain might have said that.
And I hired 6 editors to get that book to be as good as it was. And it took 6 years. I rewrote every sentence of that book 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be right. And I had no margin for error. If that book had any significant technical error, the atheist would rip me to shreds and it would be all over.
And you can't tell that he rewrote these 5 times. It reads that smoothly. Wow, I'm genuinely impressed. And what's really interesting about that, you know, what living, the book centers on the question of what happens with DNA and so on. That's the focus and interest of the book. Yeah. And what living things do with DNA is genuinely amazing. Well, Perry has become good friends with Dennis and Ray Noble, and they recently published this book called Understanding Living Systems, which is a terrific book. In my opinion, it's not as terrific as Evolution 2.0 in terms of its understandability, but it's still a wonderful, wonderful book. And, you know, it's It's Living Systems for Laypersons. Their message in that book is, never mind DNA, what whole living systems do above and beyond their DNA is even more amazing, maybe 10 times or 100 times more amazing than what they do with DNA.
Yes, true. So, like, I've figured out in the last 5 or 10 years that DNA is not even the center of the show.
No.
DNA is just like the USB stick. And what's going, to use a computer analogy, like what's going on inside the computer is so much more interesting than what goes on and off of the USB stick. It's not even funny. And so it's not even the main show. It's just what molecular biology has been obsessing about. And I latched on to it because it was digital information and I wrote an Ethernet book and I was an engineer, so I could understand it. If you want to go down an even deeper rabbit hole, go study Michael Levin. I mean, he's 20 years ahead of everybody else and he's got tons of videos. Go watch Michael Levin's TED Talk. Just search Michael Levin, yes, TED Talk and go watch it in 18 minutes. Like he's in 18 minutes, he'll take you light years beyond even DNA. And that's a guy who really appreciates how sophisticated biology really is and is not on that old script that everybody else is on. And so one of the things you'll notice, because people kind of ask me about this, is I kind of stopped trying to be the Christian apologetics guy. I'm more than qualified to do that, and I'm capable of having those conversations. But what I felt a greater lack in the world was, we need a dialogue about science that acknowledges something much bigger than nature behind nature without trying to insert miraculous events, so that we can open up dialogue about how science works. Because I think that the atheist view of evolution, which Brian was giving me in the bus, has set back cancer research 50 years.
Perry, this is your quote, isn't it? I can't remember where I quote it from, but it's absolutely correct. Random evolution is the biggest mistake in the history of science.
That's my quote, and I stand behind it.
Yeah, the cost of these blunders is incalculable. Who knows how many people are dying of cancer right this very moment because our ideas about evolution are wrong?
That's right. I said that, and I stand behind it. And the reason, so like Jin Song Lu organized a cancer conference in MD Anderson 2 months ago, and he's a pathologist who really understands how evolution really works and really understands how cancer works. And he's one of the leaders in detecting cancer at stage -1. And he read Evolution 2.0 and he's like, okay, I like that guy. I want that guy to be chairing one of the sessions at my conference. So basically, Evolution 2.0 was my PhD thesis, you could say. And what I found was, rank and file scientist, average professor, average researcher would not touch me with a barge pole. I was too controversial and they are too dependent on funding and grants and peer-reviewed papers and all that kind of stuff. But there's a few people at the tippy top layer of science that have a lot of freedom of speech and they have a lot of latitude to do what they want. And associating with one unconventional person is not going to ruin their career. And those people like what I'm doing. And so what inadvertently happened without me realizing it was I skipped past the middle all the way to the top. So like Dennis Noble is literally one of the top scientists in the world. And we're very good friends. And we understand each other because he's been fighting the same thing I've been fighting his whole career. He got to a point in his career, just like I did, where he's like, this random mutation evolution stuff is the biggest mistake in the history of science. If we don't fix this, we're never going to get anywhere. The textbooks continue to be 40 years out of date. We will continue to not cure cancer. We will continue to not understand viruses. And so, like, if you want to use this terminology, Perry's ministry ended up being in science with scientists. Mm-hmm. I remember having, when I found a book publisher, which took a long time, and we started discussing, okay, who's the market for this book? We had this, you know, is it a Discovery Channel watcher? Is it a big city Christian like a that would go to Willow Creek? Is it an agnostic? We came up with a list, and the last on the list was scientists. Like, well, that's a pretty small market. I don't know if they'd ever even pick the book up. That turned into that's who my market was, because there was this group of people in science that were absolutely seething with frustration and even rage that evolutionary biology has been screwed up so bad that we can't even talk about. So here I am. And every time Brian and I talk, he always asks, so what's going on? And there's always like an hour and a half of, oh,
yes,
I can't believe, like, I just had this conversation, with this person, and here's what they told me.
Yeah, there's a weird phenomenon where you and I might actually talk less than we could, simply because every time we do talk, we know it's going to be a 2-hour conversation. And it's like, damn, in interest of time, and Perry, if you know, because I, at some point in the next little bit, I am going to have to run off. I think this has been a great fun conversation. And I love seeing the smiling faces on the video screen. I love that you did that, Perry.
And the chat. That's been great too.
Yeah. You know, like I said, what living systems do is just so incredible. And I don't know if you can ever get to the bottom of the swamp on what living systems do, but you can know that it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful deep dive. And Perry did not know this in April of 2004. And I didn't either. And this has been just such an amazing journey. Like, who could ever have known how this was going to evolve? That this was going to lead you to writing a book, that this was going to put you at dinner tables across from the world's greatest scientists, that this was going to have you working with the greatest cancer researchers to cure cancer and to prevent cancer. Who could ever have known how this was going to evolve? I will say this, that this is unmistakably true, that I instinctually knew this and Perry instinctually knew this, that day on the bus, the presuppositions that Perry was working from kicked the ass of the presuppositions that I was working from, if that makes sense. It won. That won the day. Because Perry knew, no, there's something bigger, brighter, smarter, greater than all of us at work here. And that led you down the rabbit hole, and that won the day. So there you go.
And I needed to back up what I instinctively knew. I needed to backfill it with factual information to make it complete. And this is why so many times in your life, you know that you know that you know something, but you don't know why you know it.
Right.
And the adventure is finding out. And probably some of the stuff that you know that you know that you know is actually wrong, but that's okay. You'll get there. You can have some grace for that.
Or your model for explaining it may be wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would welcome, a little bit of conversation here before Brian goes. Brian, just tell us what time you're done, and we'll respect that. And I imagine there's probably a few questions, or if somebody wants to unmute and.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. Well, I'm reading Richard Rohr right now, and if I were he, or thinking like him, his faith is part of this discussion, and breaking down the barrier between faith and science, that belief isn't believing something even though it's not true. Faith is something different. And it is, in terms of this discussion, it is participation. The difference between participating in nature versus observing nature from the outside. And I think to me, that's different than going to the bottom of the swamp. We are the swamp. Now, I don't know any more than that. That thought just occurred to me. It's a fundamental, and it goes back to McGilchrist's idea of the right brain and the left brain. His famous book is called The Master and His Emissary.
I'm in the middle of that book right now, by the way.
Yeah. And he's got a new one that just came out.
Oh, really?
Two volumes. Yeah. He can't stop writing. Like you guys.
Is it also 600 pages long?
900. But who's counting? Right. Well, good. I've got somebody to talk to about the book. The title, Master and His Emissary, is revealing the master is the right brain. The emissary is the left brain, which is kind of like, you know, you might argue is kind of like DNA. It's the necessary but fairly limited functionality, but necessary for the whole. But it thinks it's the master and it's taken over.
Yeah.
And his argument is that we need to get back in touch with the full functioning of our brain and get the brain to operate as it did in pre-literate times, you might say, where there was more sustainable, where people didn't get so smart that they destroyed the planet.
Framing that we grew up in was very, very egocentric.
Yes,
exactly.
And that ego stuff eventually goes splat, and it's very painful. And so on the bus, arguing with Brian, I'm thinking either the engineers know something the biologists know, or the biologists know something the engineers don't know. Well, turns out there was a third answer. The plants and the tissues and the cells know something that neither the biologists nor the engineers know.
Barbara McClintock
said in her Nobel Prize paper, a challenge for the 21st century will be to understand what does a cell know about itself. My presumption in my cancer research is that a tumor is smarter than any brain or any physician or any oncologist. A teaspoon of bacteria is smarter than any team of engineers at Google. And that is the starting point for curing cancer.
And that starting point may be on the capacity of each human to, at this moment, alive, to operate, to bring forth, to embrace.
What if there is 1,000 times more wisdom and intelligence in our cells than there is in our conscious 1, 2, 3 brain with a pencil and piece of paper?
Yep. That's rather humbling. And it should be. Humility is the beginning of
wisdom.
Yes.
Yes. Klaes, I think you.
Yeah, Klaus. I really don't have anything to add, except I want to take this opportunity to thank you so much for the book. I've listened to it a few times. I also have it in my bookshelf. And now from what Brian just said, I'm going to take a fresh listen to it again, because it has helped me so much. I have some similar background to you two, you guys, in that although later in life, I got into a very conservative church and young earth creationism. I was fascinated by it, and then I got into intelligent design, and then sort of you took the big step and the stuff you've connected to after that. I'm just say thank you.
Well, thank you, and all of you, write us an Amazon review and review the podcast and do all that stuff, and it helps more people find out about it. Let's hear from Kelly.
I just love the fact that it's not even the whole story.
No, it's only a scratch on the surface. Those 5 Swiss Army knife blades and all that genetic stuff, it's just the tip of the iceberg. Jeff
has his hand raised.
I have a dumb question that has nothing to do with what we've been talking about, but I'm just curious. Brian, your last name, Todd, you didn't choose the same last name that Perry chose. How did you get to choose Todd?
My birth name is Brian Todd Sink, S-I-N-K, just like the kitchen sink, which is a name that comes from Germany by way of North Carolina. And that is still my full legal name. Perry did not like that name. And in 2002, 2001, something like that, went to the county court and had it legally changed to Marshall, which is just
your mother's maiden name, correct?
Mom's family name.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I went to court and the judge said, Mr. Sink, why do you want to change your name? And I said, Your Honor, it's better to be a sheriff than a kitchen appliance. And he goes, I'm not going to touch that. And then he signs off. So, so I changed my name 22 years ago. Yeah. And there you go.
I just, for my official work stuff, I just sawed off the Sink part of the name and went by Todd. And
yeah, I got so this, one more question
for this Brian. Is one of the Easter eggs of Planet Perry that you get to discover.
So, Brian, you mentioned you had a lot of anger. Do you feel like you have overcome that anger and like healed from it? Is it gone?
Yes.
Or like, and how do you refer to yourself spiritually today?
I still like the term agnostic. I will never, ever, ever, ever use the word atheist to describe me. The anger, literally, it went from an 8 or a 9 or a 10 down to a 0.3 that day at that church in Austin, Texas. I still get grouchy about dogmatic fundamentalist Christians, understandably, but I think most of us do. I like the word agnostic. I love the idea that we live in an incredibly smart universe and that specifically living things are an indication that this is a conscious universe that knows itself and allows us to know it and allows us to know ourselves. Is that helpful?
Yes. Thank you.
And I say that is a far more productive hypothesis for doing science than the materialistic narrative.
It wins.
We have this battle between an atheistic narrative and God made the world through a series of miraculous interventions. And, you know, a zebra appeared on the grass munching, you know, grass in the savannah one day. And those two sides are so caught up in their own egos, as Richard Rohr would say, they're never going to get anywhere. And I consistently find that the best scientists are the ones, they're like, it's a paradox. It's like, this is way more intricate than we can ever figure it out. But we can, by little bit, we can figure it out. And we're just at the very beginning of this journey, and we have to be humble and let nature. Like, I know researchers who, they won't ever say this on their blog and they won't ever say it in a scientific paper, but they'll walk into their lab and they'll go, I want these C. elegans worms to tell me their secrets. C. elegans worms, will you please tell me your secrets? And that's how they, at a gut level, approach their work.
And that is the presupposition that wins.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, what you're talking about there, Perry, is, you know, years ago at your Rosetta Stone, you talked about intracellular signaling techniques. And all that is communication.
Yeah.
Which, of course, feedback loops are the basis of all communication in all of creation, all of it. Everything. And then the things that we create are feedback loops. And so I guess, and this is a loaded question, Brian, or if this is too much, I don't even know how long you have. Jeff asked the question about the anger. I was going to ask you how you process that. I have a bazillion questions for you, but I guess before reality, here's my supposition, before reality is actually relationship. And I'm going back to my understanding of the creation story before Holy Spirit brooded over the waters. Before Jesus uttered those beautifully fateful words, light be, there was this harmonic perichoresis, the divine dance. That relationship, from what we understand, was intact. And it was, so relationship presupposes anything if we take the biblical worldview, the biblical lens, that relationship, which is the pattern of our harmonic relationship with all of us. So my question is, what's the relationship that's sustaining you now?
That's a heavy question.
Yeah, so I don't know if you have time, and I would love to hear this in a video or talk to you just to get to know you.
Okay.
But I'm offering it to you. I'm an executive coach. And so we have a saying in coaching that the best coaching happens between sessions, where you ask a good question and then you're washing the dishes or digging in the dirt or whatever. But I just, that's all, because it's those relationships that sustain us. That's why I ask.
One of the pieces for me that is understanding your own self and all the wonderful and amazing intricacies. Even John Paul Mendoza, for a few of you who know who he is, like him or don't like him, it's all the same. He said to me a year ago, he said, the greatest aha of all is self-awareness. So that's a piece of it. I really enjoyed the book Biocentrism by Robert Lanza.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Paul, part of my response to what you said is, my view is that consciousness and conscious awareness in the universe, I like the model that says everything started with consciousness and matter and energy came after that, not the other way around. I like that model a lot. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Say that one more time.
Everything in the universe is consciousness and starts with consciousness, and matter and energy came after that, not the other way around.
Right.
That's just my summary off the top of my head.
Well, because matter and energy can be measured, but consciousness, we can't.
Right.
Right. Well, I am going to have to go. Perry, any last things you want to, by the way, thank you. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Klaus. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Jeff. These were great questions and comments.
I think that's it. I just really appreciate that you all are interested in hearing this and following the story along. And I know a lot of you, some of you really well, and it's been a fun adventure. And I just want to encourage you, you know, I think everybody's got their own version of the story, or you wouldn't be here. And it's all about just having the courage to follow the rabbit hole wherever it leads. So yeah, thank you. And we'll, I think we should turn this into a podcast episode. So we'll get this out there and post it on YouTube and stuff. And thank you everybody for being here. It was a treat.
Thank you for having
it. Thank you, Perry.
Bye, all.
Thank you, everyone.
Here.
Until next time, this is the Evolution 2.0 podcast, bridging science, technology, business, and the big questions. To ensure you never miss an episode, subscribe on iTunes or on your preferred player. If you like the show, rate us on iTunes. Join our email list and social media at cosmicfingerprints.com.